It's 1 o'clock, and it is time now for your appointment with Elizabeth Barrett, the reluctant therapist. Hi, Elizabeth. What's on our minds today?
What's on my mind today, Brad, is relationships, which tends to be on my mind often. But today, we're going to be talking about family estrangement, which has been a very common topic. If you spend any time on your socials or listening to any, you know, podcasts or pop TV or current news, the idea of estrangement, whether it's adult children cutting off ties with their parents or in some cases parents cutting off ties with their children, it has become a really prevalent issue, and one that's not without controversy, because like a lot of things in our culture, when something catches on, a buzzword catches on, it starts to travel through the zeitgeist of life really quickly, and people jump on these bandwagons really quickly, and the next thing we know, we've got a lot of people who have altered their lives in ways that end up being really troublesome, and they're not quite sure how to get themselves back. And estrangement has been one of those hot topics that has taken off in the cultural discourse, and a lot of people have changed their family relationships in ways that has in long term been harmful. And in a lot of other ways, it is part of the story of kind of the undermining of our social and personal and familial fabrics that we're seeing all over the country, and in many cases all over the world, that if you look at why people are struggling with their mental health, there's a lot of reasons. But one of the core reasons is that they find themselves alone, lonely, isolated, disconnected, which can lead to a lot of mental health issues. We've tricked ourselves or been told a story or narrative that we can survive solely on our own experiences. And then we've kind of doubled down by having our screens and in-home theaters and ways that we can isolate. And we spend less time, you know, joining clubs or being a part of community events. And we've seen this incremental rise in mental health issues as we've seen people less connected to society, to their communities, to their neighbors, and now to their own families. And that is a direct result for our mental health issues, is these cutoffs and this isolation and the loneliness that comes with that. The thing that's challenging about the topic of family estrangement, just like the challenge of the topic of divorce, and the two are going to have some overlapping connection, is that there, for some people, is a deep need and necessity to have some sort of break in relationships that are harmful. But it's not as common as you would think. When I first started working 30-something years ago, and I worked for the county with families who were in highly combative and emergency situations, I did in-home crisis family counseling. And the thing that I found really interesting with a lot of these families is that they had a lot of conflict and challenges, and their communication was terrible, and their relationships were struggling. And as a brand new therapist, my thought was, gosh, why do you keep hanging out with these people? And why do you keep going to the family Thanksgivings? Why do you keep having these parties if all that is conflict? But what I've come to realize years and years later, that what are the strengths these families that I worked with in the county, who were in many cases low socioeconomic, struggling with education, struggling with access to resources, they had that social safety net of their family ties. They may brawl all the time, but they came together for weddings and showers and birthday parties, and they knew they had each other's back. And that stuck with me throughout these years as I've seen more and more people struggle, that the common denominator is they don't have a strong support system that's tied to family. And I hope we talk about found family and forged families, and this idea that we can just substitute those familial relationships with non-blood ties. So without further ado, We're going to jump into our conversation today because I am so happy to have Michelle Wiener Davis back on the air with me. She was here, I think it was almost 2 years ago, which is a shame. We should be talking every couple of months. But if you don't recognize Michelle's name, you know her work because she is the author of what became the seminal book about divorce called Divorce Busting. She was the first person to have the courage during this time period 40 plus years ago when divorce was at its peak to say, hey, maybe this shouldn't be happening. Maybe we shouldn't be just marching down the road to divorce and cheering on people who are getting divorced because there's a lot of unintended consequences. And in writing this book, Michelle opened up a whole different conversation that has led to her institute, Divorce Busting Center in Boulder, Colorado. She's written 8 best-selling books, another one including The Sex-Starved Marriage, A Couple's Guide to Boosting Their Marriage Libido, which is another great topic and incredibly important in keeping things together. And then throughout all these years, Michelle has been an internationally renowned relationship expert, speaking all over the world, sharing her knowledge as a licensed clinical social worker and MFT. And today she's here to talk about estrangement because it's something that's become very personal and informative of her work and her practice and her life. So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist right here at our new time, 1 to 2 p.m. every Tuesday. And you can find me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, leave me a note there. You can also find our show and podcast through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, subscribe, and you can listen at your convenience or also share with other people. Especially today's show will be a great one to share with friends and family, I am sure. But we're going to take a quick break and come back and get into our conversation with Michelle Wiener Davis right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good to mom, blood's thicker than the mud, it's a family affair.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And welcome, Michelle, to the show. I'm so glad you're here.
And I am so glad that I'm here. I felt such a connection to you even prior to the first time we spoke on your podcast. And, you know, what a great podcast it was. And it's interesting, as you were giving a little bit of your background and working with families, I didn't realize that that's yet another thing we really have in common. You know, I started out as a family therapist and for, I think it was about 9 years, worked at a social service agency with many of the same families that you just described with, and so many times my reaction was so similar to yours about the connection that they had and how important their family was, even though it was often so chaotic. So yet another similarity. And then today, as we're talking to each other, I realize we both got that memo about wearing pink shirts.
Absolutely.
So yet another thing we have in common. You know, it's interesting you're mentioning about what most people know me for, and that's that issue about helping couples prevent divorce if possible. And yes, it was a very unusual message, especially coming from a therapist, that, you know, let's slow things down if you're having trouble in your marriage to really, really make sure that you leave no stone unturned and that divorce should not be looked upon as just a rite of passage as it had become. It had become so normalized. And I think in a similar way, that is what's been happening in our culture regarding ending relationships with other important family members. And in fact, I have been, you know, doing some writing, and, you know, part of my title is family estrangement, the new divorce. And
Yes.
it is absolutely positively breaking my heart. And I don't know if you know this, but all those years that I've done training for mental health professionals, talking about teaching them how to become divorce-busting therapists. Sometimes, you know, the training would be for 2 or 3 days at a time. And inevitably, someone would ask me toward the end of our time together, Michelle, can you be a good divorce-busting or a good marriage therapist if you've been divorced yourself? And my response was always, absolutely. But then I said something they didn't expect.
Which was?
If you want to be a really good marriage therapist, you cannot have emotional cutoffs in your life. You can't teach couples about love. If your go-to strategy when relationships become difficult is to just say, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And then I went on to talk about my perspective of the pain that emotional cutoffs leave in their wake. And during that time, you could always, always hear a pin drop in the room, because I truly believe there wasn't a single person sitting in that room, and I've been doing this for a really, really long time, whose life wasn't touched by ending, either their ending an important relationship with somebody or vice versa. And here's what was, I'm glad I have a pretty strong ego, because at the end of those days, people would line up to talk to me. Oh, not about the topic of my training. They wanted to share their stories of, you know, the brother that they hadn't spoken to in 5 years, or the sister that they missed, or the parent that they would consider calling after they left the training. And it's been a thing, a subject that I'm passionate about and have been passionate about for many, many years.
What year did you write Divorce Busting? Let's put it in social context.
Well, it was published in 1992. So it was, you know, the late 80s where I was, you know, sort of working on it, putting it together. And it was published in 92. And I remember I did a keynote and it was, I think it was called Divorce Busting. And I shared the stage with another pretty well-known therapist and presenter. And it was, her topic was the good divorce. And the conference producer was a little nervous about how people would respond to the two of us. I have to tell you that at the end, I always read the evaluations because I want constructive feedback. And I was almost a little embarrassed about how well received my message of you need to try to work things out first really landed. In these were all mental health professionals. So I was really excited about that.
Well, and having been through my training in the, I started in 93 and I started working in 94. So I was familiar with your work pretty much from the get-go. What surprised me is how little training we had in divorce busting or even helping couples work through issues, and how little sex education we had going through. And as I've, you know, moved through my career these 30 plus years, it continues to be an issue that I find connected, that you have clinicians who are very well versed in anxiety skills and depression and parenting in some cases, but very little training and skills in actual relational work in keeping couples together. They know how to sit through combat and conflict, you know, conflict negotiation, but in the actual healing of and improving and strengthening marriages, they have very little training or experience that has not happened. And they know so little about the importance of sex and intimacy. And why is that? How can we be in a profession that's been around for so long and fail to meet the two things that really are at the heart of a successful, thriving relationship?
Yikes. You know, you just raised so many important issues all at one time. I don't know where to begin.
Sorry. Choose. You may choose.
The one thing I would say that I totally agree with you on is that I don't think things have changed all that much. I mean, there's more talk about relationships and couples therapy, but in terms of really training people to gear their work towards seeing if resolution and relationship enhancement is possible as a primary way to work. And then if it doesn't, then there are other things people can do. But I don't think things have changed all that much, because I will tell you that when I work with people, I don't just work with couples who are doing okay and they want a really great relationship. That doesn't happen for me. I work very often with couples where one person wants in desperately, and just as desperately, the other person wants out. And they have often been to other therapists, and what they will tell me is that they've told their therapist that the only reason they're sitting in that room is because they're kids, because had there not been kids, they wouldn't even be there. And they have shared with me, because I always ask, what did your therapist say to that? I have heard this so many times. Therapists often say, well, that's not a good enough reason, because your kids are going to leave home. So what is it that you love about your spouse? Listen, if they're sitting in your room and they're teetering on the brink of the divorce, it's likely that in that moment, there's nothing they love about their spouse. It's not the right question. And so when someone says that to me, and they do, they say, Michelle, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for my kids. You know what I say to them? I say, the fact that you're here because of your kids tells me how much you love them and how much you care about their well-being. So it makes me really curious, where in your life did you learn about the importance of family? My question at least opens up the possibility that their mutual love for their children isn't necessarily an end point, but it's certainly a reasonable starting point for our work together. And it's also an indication that if they were to choose that as a reason to begin to work on their marriage, it doesn't mean that they're settling for less or that they're denying themselves of what they really deserve. It's making it a valid starting place. And so part of what I'm saying there is that every time someone speaks, every time a client speaks, we have a choice. Do we respond? Do we wait? If we respond, do we make a statement? Do we ask a question? And the kinds of questions and statements that we make, that's where we don't get training, because people think that there is such a thing as neutrality in therapy. And it's a myth. There is no such thing. And yet, I could easily understand how a therapist might think asking the question, what do you love about your spouse, when someone just said, the only reason I'm here is for my kids, they may think that's a neutral question. But in the sequence of the conversation, it is not. It's bound to backfire.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Michelle Wiener Davis. She is an internationally renowned relationship expert. I'm going to keep using that as your title because it's true. After 40 plus years of helping couples to find their way back to each other through her divorce busting work, but also in building intimacy in her work, The Sex Star of Marriage. And we're going to move into her new work around estrangement. But I want to stick with the couples counseling because I think it's so pertinent for so many people. One, people and I, so I have been teaching at Cal Poly for 18 years, and one of the classes is Introduction to Counseling Profession. So I have this captive group of nubile young people thinking I'm going to become a family therapist, and I always ask why, and it's always because they've been in therapy since they were 10. And my second response is always, "That's too long." Your therapist should not be your guru or your best friend. And number two, why would you want to spend your life in a place where you've been struggling? So that's where we start. But then we talk about a lot of the challenges of this profession and where it's going, and the idea that we bring to the work who we are and our perspective and our life experiences. And so I will say to my students, I will say to my listeners, before you hand your life story over to a therapist, make sure their life story aligns with what you believe, because that therapist is coming to their work through the lens through which they've lived their life and the choices they've made. There's no sin of having gone through a divorce or had life experiences, but I don't want someone who's never been successful in marriage counseling anyone I love and care about.
I think we need to join forces, because I know that before I die, that's a message that I really want the general public to understand, because mm-hmm. they do not understand it. You're absolutely, absolutely right about that.
And I don't know how we address it, because again, our profession has become so medicalized and focused on meds and neuroscience, which again, that's not the worst, and also in depression and anxiety and bipolar. But if you look at the money that's been spent through the National Institute of Mental Health, their ex-president, in his own admission, said we spent $75 million in neuroscience work and never came up with a solution to help people's relational issues, which is the primary thing that brings them into counseling, whether it's their children, their intimate partnerships, you know, their person, their relationship to themselves. And so I don't know how we fix it as long as we keep focusing away from the things that make people's life meaningful. And
well,
focus
so,
on.
So, you know, I really have to say the research shows, as you know, that the salient ingredient in mm-hmm. successful therapeutic outcome is the relationship between the therapist and the client. It's like
Absolutely.
Who we are as people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I may have shared this with you the last time we spoke, I'm not sure, but, you know, I was part of that group in Milwaukee, the Brief Family Therapy Center team. It's where I got trained, and then it's where I worked, and I was part of the team that developed that solution-focused model.
I didn't know that.
There was the birth of divorce busting, and I'll tell you why. So we would sit, as trainees, we would sit behind the one-way mirror and watch these brilliant veteran therapists working. And I was so in awe of how skilled they really were and how much they knew. And I just loved being there. And I was learning at the same time. What I started to realize is that even though I had shifted the way I thought about doing therapy to a solution-focused way so that we were in sync, mm-hmm. When they worked with clients, even though we had the same theoretical orientation, they handled situations differently. I remember the moment on a Tuesday evening, I'm sitting behind the one-way mirror, and a couple comes in, and they were having some struggles, and the therapist, again, very experienced therapist, was asking them questions to see whether they could come up with some resolutions to the problems that they were having. And when it seemed kind of tough, I remember that that person shifted gears into what I would characterize as the inevitability of divorce mm-hmm. or parting ways. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting there going, no, wait. There are other things you could ask. Mm-hmm. And it was at that moment I realized that when you go to a therapist, people look for what kind of therapy, whether it's EFT or solution focused or CBT or mm-hmm. Whatever alphabet soup therapy you want to go to, they decide on the basis of the brand of therapy. And yet what you really get is the person mm-hmm. behind the therapy model. You get the person with their values, with their life experiences, with their perspectives. So it's no wonder, because I know you know something about this, but one of the most challenging experiences of my life was when after 23 years of my parents' marriage, I wasn't 23, I was only 16 at the time, mm-hmm. no fighting, no arguing, wonderful extended family, as close as we could possibly be. My mom sat us being me and my two brothers down and my dad and announced that she was getting divorced. No one knew it was going to happen. And it truly, that was, I didn't realize it at the time, But not only did my parents' relationship end at that point, that I knew, that means divorce, but all the extended family, the village that my parents had built around us, completely fell apart. And my mother always used to like to point out that had it not been for her decision to divorce, I wouldn't have a best-selling book, and I wouldn't be talking to you right now, Elizabeth. So,
that's a little dark, but I get it.
But the truth really is that, where was I going with all of this?
How it probably informed your perspective as a clinician moving forward.
Exactly. And so, thank you. And so when I sit in a room with people and I could have someone equally experienced in solution-focused thinking, we would go in different directions. If that person was happily married in their third marriage, we would go in different directions. And the people who come and seek our help simply do not know this.
No, they don't. And for me, and now we're kind of diving more into therapy, but let's stay with it. I went through a period of time before I even got trained where my husband and I were at a crossroads. And it was at a time where we weren't sure we were going to stay together. And what was, in hindsight, blew me away is how many of our friends said, oh, well, all, you know, 50% of all marriages end in divorce. Like, nobody fought for us. They were just like, oh, too bad. But for us, we had, our daughter was 3 at the time, and neither one of us was willing to leave her behind. We'd made this human together. And you mentioned that earlier about couples. If it weren't for a child, that was kind of us in that moment. It's like, well, we made this human.
It's
and
kind of everybody,
of us,
by the way.
We're not walking. And that began our journey of figuring out, like, there's a reason we came together. There's a reason why we've made a family. And this contract of marriage is bigger than our individual desires. And so that informed all of my work. And just as a side note, you were trained in solution focused. I was trained in depth psychology. So they're 180 from each other. But the way we've come to the work because of our life experiences is very much aligned. And again, what I tend to ask clients very early on is, what is it that you want the end of your life to look like? What is it you're working towards? Because then I can help you navigate that. I don't care as much what's happening right in this moment. I need to know where it is you think you want to be at the end of this journey. And that's been really helpful in my work, because when clients stop being mired in where they are and they start thinking about why they started this and where they want to be when they're 80, then we can get there.
That's such a beautiful
question. Because 90% of the time they say, I want to be with someone who is my partner and my love. And we look back over our life and the story and the things we've created together. And I said, you don't get there easily.
That's
but
right.
You started. Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful question. I really like that so much. That's
you great. May have it. I pass it to you.
Thank you. Well, you know, and it also resonates with me because I was, despite my mother's decision to divorce, she and I were joined at the hip. We were very, very close. And, you know, she, unfortunately, I moved her to Colorado where I live to be closer to me and my family. And, 2 very short years after I moved her here, she got killed in a car accident.
Oh my goodness.
And it was unbelievably devastating for me. And I, like many people who grieve, spent probably a good year or year and a half, I woulda, shoulda, coulda, you know, all of those things. And if I hadn't moved her from Florida to, you know, but she wouldn't have slipped on ice. I mean, all that stuff. And it took me a while to kind of get out of that. But one of the things that has been a blessing for me, and it's a long way of saying that why I love that question, is I just decided, you know, because I had so many regrets, even I should have done this, I should have done that, that I now look at myself and my life and ask myself, where do I want to be 5 years from now? Where do I want to be 10 years from now? How do I want to be remembered?
Yes.
And the way that I'm living my life today in alignment with those values. Mm-hmm. And if they, and you know, we sort of shift on a little bit now and then, we get off track a little, but that is my guiding principle these mm-hmm. days. And so that I don't look back and have regrets. And so I do have a clear vision, a 30,000 foot vision of like who I want to be and where I want to be. So I love that question. I think it's really great.
Thank you. And I use that also, you know, because my book, The Parent Way, the workbook that I worked with families forever, that's kind of the heart of the book, is to start with, what is your goal in bringing these humans into the world? Where do you want them to be? And what? How are you going to model for them the life you'd like them to live? Because what we know as systems therapists is that our children become a product of what they saw growing up in our home. And so The Parent Way begins and ends with, what is it? What kind of life do you want your children to live? And you need to live it now so that they can follow your lead. Yeah. So they all kind of align. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Michelle Wiener-Davis. We're not going to have enough time to cover everything. I can already feel that. This is likely going to be the beginning of a series. But we're talking about our experience as therapists and Michelle's seminal work in bringing divorce busting to the cultural conversation at a time where divorce was considered just a rite of passage, and now moving forward into the conversation around estrangement and how that's impacted families and what the role of clinicians has been in pushing these estrangements for better or worse for many families. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue the conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got.
I'm Elizabeth Baird, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, here today with my guest, Michelle Wiener-Davis. And I don't want the hour to get away from us. So let's talk about how you found your way into the conversation about family estrangement. What led you there?
That's a perfect question. And I really think that so many therapists, if not all therapists, they develop a specialization or an interest in a particular topic because it's a lived experience. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. is certainly true for me. Just going back, you know, very briefly, my mother's decision to divorce and came after she had spent some time with a therapist who then said to her, you know, you've tried lots of things. I think it's time for you to end your relationship and go find yourself. Mm-hmm. I always kind of joke, even though it's about 60 decades later, I'd like to go find that therapist. You know, mm-hmm. So that was one piece of it. But there is another piece, and it's more directly related to family estrangement. Since you've had Dr. Joshua Coleman on your podcast,
yes, I have.
Before, I'm sure he has talked about how often divorce is a catalyst for family estrangement. And that has certainly been the case in my family. So I was just leaving home when my parents' marriage fell apart. I had no older brother who was already out of the home. I did have a younger brother. And I can honestly say that when my parents divorced, and by the way, this is about the research, they're not, you know, singular in this way. They were focused on getting their own lives back on track. Mm-hmm. And he was not the priority that he should have been as an 11 or 12-year-old kid. It's not to say that they neglected him. They loved him very much. But he went from having, you know, helicopter parents to not, you know. Mm-hmm. And as he got older, he began to feel a hole in his heart because of that. And then when he left home and went to college and he went to a therapist, mm-hmm. the therapist helped him to decide that he'd be better off if he stopped talking to my mother. And so for 10 years, my younger brother did not speak to my mother. And I could, because I was very close to her, I could feel the pain, even though I didn't have kids of my own and I couldn't really imagine what that would be like. I could feel the pain in every cell of my body as she tried time and time again to reach out to him, to send him letters, to call him, to offer to come and visit. And every letter she sent him, and this is before email days, every letter she sent him, she received return to sender. And so it was very painful for me as an older sister, feeling like I was caught in the middle. And I did my very best to try to mediate and to convince him to re-up his relationship with my mother, to no avail, by the way. And it wasn't until I realized that if I continued to do what I had been doing, I was going to lose my brother too, because he was getting annoyed at me. And I did not want to lose him, but that created other issues, because now I felt disloyal to my mother, even though she understood. And, you know, sort of disappointed in my brother, but I still kept contact because I didn't want to lose him. And what it wasn't until a very sort of ironic thing happened. 10 years later, my then sister-in-law asked my brother for a divorce. She said she wanted a divorce, and he was so traumatized by having to go through that again. They had a 2-year-old daughter. Thought of going through an unwanted divorce, having to share custody, was really more than I think he was about to flip out. And he called my mother, who by the way, was also a therapist. He called my mother, and she was driving in the car. And he said, "Mom, I know we haven't spoken for a really long time, but I'm getting a divorce, and I'm so devastated. I need help. Are you willing to talk to me?" And my mother, driving her car, said, "Of course, but let me pull over." And once she was safely parked, together they sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And they re-upped their relationship. And I would say that from that point until she died, even though they had their share of ups and downs, they did stay in contact. And truly, you know, this is the other piece of it. When my mom died suddenly and tragically in a car accident, and there I was with all of her stuff, I was going through her stuff and found a folder with my brother's name on it, and I opened it up, and there in my hands were all of his return to sender letters. And I remember holding those letters in my hand and crying and thinking, what a waste, what a complete waste. And also wondering, why in the world did my mom hang on to those letters? They must have held such meaning for her. And so of course, being, you know, the caring therapist, you know, that I am, or caring person, if I can do anything to help people avoid a similar fate, that's my job. You know, whether it's a parent and an adult kid, or two spouses, or two long-term friends, or coworkers. Look, not every relationship can be salvaged. And there truly are. And I know you've had this experience too, Elizabeth, where you've sat with people and you hear their backgrounds and you want to cry because you can't believe people have had to endure that. I absolutely get that there are abusive relationships, but here's what I don't get. I will never get to the point, regardless of the history, of immediately assuming that there's only one outcome, that there's work to be done to find out if other solutions are possible.
There's so much to that. One, the systems therapist in me said, no doubt that he got divorced because he never did the work of that system. But two, you know, I interviewed a woman a few months ago who wrote a book about her estrangement with her mother, and her mother had been incredibly abusive all of her life. And yet, instead of allowing that abuse to end their tie, she leaned into the relationship and wanted to know her mother underneath what that abuse was and what drove her mother's abuse. And they were able to like heal that. And they live together. I think her mom's in her 90s now. But that story, that interview really struck me. And it was followed with an article in the New York Times last week about a young woman who grew up in a conservative Jewish family and married a woman, and her father was just not going to have it and didn't have anything to do with her, and really caused a lot of pain, which in a lot of cases would have led to estrangement. And yet the daughter again said, I needed to lean into the family ties because it's my history and my religion and my family. And my father agreed to go to therapy with me with the intention of healing this. And she wrote about it. And so there's a couple cracks in this idea that the only option out is estrangement. People are talking a little tiny bit about it, but not as much as they're talking about how if things are uncomfortable, it's easier to leave. And I want to jump over to the what happens.
Can you hold that thought? Because I want to say something, Beth.
Yeah.
One of the speakers at this conference on family estrangement that I just went to, she had been estranged from her mother for quite a long time, and then she decided that she wanted to reconnect. And then someone from the audience asked her, in what ways did your mother change that precipitated that connection? And she said, my mother didn't change at all. She's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I changed. Mm-hmm. And she wanted a relationship despite some of the challenges. She also, like you just described, you know, no matter how old we get, we're still people and we have our histories. And, I've been thinking a lot about this. I could have estranged from my mother because her decision to divorce my dad was one of the most devastating things in my life. Mm-hmm. And then I've had other disappointments in my life, and I've asked myself, like with my brother, or now, by the way, my niece doesn't talk to my brother.
And oh, I could, systems.
I imagine that. Mm-hmm. And I could be upset with my niece, but I don't have emotional cutoffs in my life. And I started to think about sort of in that solution focused way, instead of analyzing the problem, I want to analyze the solution. Why don't I have emotional cutoffs? And you know why? It's precisely what you're talking about there. Instead of asking, how could they? You know, I ask, what is it about who they are that would make them want to make that decision? What was my mother feeling in her marriage that would make her want to get out? What was my brother trying to protect his heart from that would make him stop talking to my mother for so long? Mm-hmm. It's really seeing people as people with all their frailties and understanding that sometimes the behavior that is the most triggering to us mm-hmm. has nothing to do with us. It's all about the other person and their history and their Achilles heel and their tenderness. And being, I know it's a big job to mm-hmm. try to understand that when you're hurting. And I get that. But I think it's what we all have to do. Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Michelle Wiener Davis, known for work in divorce busting and in couples intensive therapies for 40 plus years. And now stepping into estrangement, family estrangement, and their connection kind of between divorce and estrangement. So, Michelle, because we're kind of on a roll with therapy. What is your concern about the role our current therapeutic practices have in estrangement as it did in the divorce era as well?
When a person goes to a therapist and they're unhappy in a relationship, be it a marital relationship or a parent-child relationship, and they complain to the therapist about what isn't working, most therapists who are not systemic thinkers, mm-hmm. which is a specific training, mm-hmm. most therapists assume the story that they're hearing, the narrative that they're hearing, is the complete story. And they tend to ask about feelings and validate the feelings. And then on the basis of that one-sided story, diagnose the person who they have never met. And once a diagnosis happens, like this is a toxic relationship, your mother is a narcissist, I can't believe how you have been how there's gaslighting going on here. You know all the buzzwords. As soon as those labels are assigned, hopefulness shuts down. It becomes all about blame. And there's a little sense of relief. Oh, it's not me. It's that person. And the way to solve this problem is to stay away from that person. And what is so damaging, as far as I'm concerned, is it's important for the therapist to find out, okay, well, what's going on? What happened? And by the way, that doesn't even happen because so often clients will use adjectives. My mother is controlling. My father's a narcissist. And a lot of therapists don't look under the hood and ask, when you say that your mother's controlling, what is it exactly that she's doing that makes you feel that way? To really find out what are these behaviors. And then to say, when your mother has acted that way, not who she is, but acted that way, how have you responded? And how did that work? And then when that didn't work, what else did you try? To really find out what's going on there. And then to not invite this other person into the room to talk about what's going on, and then also to discover the potential that this person has and the motivation that this person has to change. And for me, that's key. You know, are you willing to accept responsibility for your role in this? Are you willing to think about this in a different way? Are you willing to do something different? And for me, that is the kind of diagnosis I'm much more interested in than what I would consider sort of a stagnant description of behavior. My mother always does this. She always asks me these questions when I told her not to. And change.
Are we talking about boundaries?
Yeah, right.
That's, I know. Let's go one step further with this, because imagine if I'm listening to us right now and it's hitting, resonating with someone, they're going to want to ask, but how do I know if my relationship isn't so toxic and damaging that I should be in it? How do I know if estrangement, you know, if I should reach out to my parents? Like, how? What are some nuggets we can give people? And it's the same with divorce. Like, what are those cues that say, no, this is something worth pursuing? And are there cues for that? Or is it just dumb luck? Some relationships work and some don't.
Well, I don't think it's dumb luck. What I think is, if you are having an issue with another person in your life, it doesn't matter who it is, go to someone who's trained to work with relationships, not just an individual therapist. Because here's what will happen. The individual therapist will have your best interest at heart, true. But what they'll do is they want to know about your past history, your feelings, your thoughts. They will validate your feelings. It's like going to a friend and saying what a jerk your husband is. And your friend will say, yeah, I can't believe he did that. Why in the world would you live with that? But a therapist, really, we're not supposed to be friends. We're supposed to be offering people different ways of looking at things. That said, there are times where the interactions are so painful and so hurtful, and if that other person is unwilling to do things differently, to meet in the middle, to acknowledge what has been painful, then sometimes I would say there needs to be a break. But I again, I'm never going to go to, you need to cut them out of your life for 10 years like my brother did. Take some time off. Make sure you're getting some help to make sure you've left no stone unturned, you know, because here's the deal. Even what feels like a relief in the moment, it can still lead to long-term bittersweet pain. And I do think, and the research shows this, that even when let's say adult children are saying that they do feel greatly relieved by not interacting with their parents, that there's almost always some ambivalence. There's almost always some missing, some sadness. And if by doing things just a little bit differently, and by the way, there's another colleague of mine who cut off his mother for a very long time. And when he talked about reconnecting with her, which he did, not only did he reconnect as she was getting ill and her illness was, it was terminal, he took such great care of her. And when asked about, again, her changes, it really wasn't about her changes. It was about him and being able to see her as a person, being able to focus on the good rather than the bad, being able to understand when the bad happened, that it really, he got more skilled at letting it sort of go. You know, there are all sorts of things a person can do to not allow themselves to be as triggered by things that have happened.
I probably would step more on the controversial side of things always as the reluctant therapist, but I believe, and especially having done work with families again that were really chaotic all the time, and yet it was the only security net that these people had when push came to shove, economically, emotionally, and access to resources, housing, that they had to live with parents who had been abusive or cousins that they didn't get along with, but it was a survival thing. And I think part of the conversation needs to be about the pragmatic piece of, yes, this relationship may not have been perfect, and they may have crossed boundaries or said things that were hurtful or, been harmful in some ways. But at the end of the day, we have to look out for those people in our group, in our system. I am a trained systems person, and so when I look at families, I just look at the chain of events that happen generation after generation after generation, because we repeat the patterns. And my experience is that when people cut off family members, that let's say parents, adult children, parents, they go on and repeat the same mistakes. They end up getting divorced, or they end up getting cheated on, or they parent incorrectly and their child cuts them off. And that's, you don't cut off a family member and the chain of events stops there. Unless you do the internal work to understand why you're here on the planet, and that is to be of support and service of others, you are destined to continue to have those same cutoff experiences with friends, with coworkers, and wonder, why do all these rotten people end up in my life? And not recognizing that that cutoff that you went through is not going to be the only one. You've now set up generations of it. Thoughts? Because divorce is generational, right? The odds of getting divorced, if your parents got divorced, is like 187%. I mean, it's off the charts. So
You know,
estrangement carries on.
you talked about this when you were speaking about yourself, and then I think it fits into what you're talking about here, that when you and your husband were having a little bit of a struggle,
A
and
big.
then you looked at, or a big struggle, and you look at your daughter, that you realize that this decision is bigger than just the two of you. I think, culturally speaking, back in the day when, you know, you were working with families in their houses and I was doing the same, there was more of a sense of we, you know, the usness to things. And somehow culturally, we have gone for, and by the way, there's probably some bad parts to that too, where you're a people
Absolutely.
pleaser and you never take care of yourself and you're always doing things for other people and you're depleted. And I get that. But what I've discovered, and this is in marriage relationships that I work with, when one partner has been that people pleaser and then they're so sick and tired of it that, you know, 20 years later, they throw in the towel. They typically go like from being sort of mousy and not saying anything and just doing everything all the way over here, which is it's all about me. And I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to defend myself and I'm going to live the rest of my life all about me. And I think that's happened culturally too, actually. And for me, at least the way I see life and what's important, it isn't here and it isn't there, it's here.
In
And
that
when did
middle.
we get the idea that we shouldn't care about other people's feelings? When did that happen? We threw the baby out with the bathwater. That to me, you know, when when I work with people and someone says, you know, I really do want, and sometimes I separate them during the intensive, and the person who's thinking they want out, they'll say, you know, I really do want out, but, you know, I do feel really kind of guilty about it. But I went to another therapist and my therapist told me not to feel guilty and the kids would be okay. And I always say to them, you know, help me understand this better. Tell me the difference between feeling guilt or having concern or a conscience or caring about another person's feelings, because I'm a little confused about the difference. One of the ideas that I try to get across is that if this person that I'm talking about chose to stay in this marriage, it doesn't have to be because you're giving up a dream or you're settling for less in your life. It's because part of you is a person who really cares about other people's feelings. Part of you is a person who cares about the wholeness of the family. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that part of you. And I don't think therapists are trained to talk to people like this. Mm-hmm. It's all about what makes you feel better, what makes you feel happier. And that's okay, as long as it includes caring about other people as part of your happiness. That's okay. It's not codependent, and it's not a dysfunction. It's a beautiful thing.
One of the things I say to my students at the beginning and middle and end of every quarter is your only job in life is to find a way to live that supports your mental health and well-being and the mental health and well-being of those you are loving and responsible for. And that's a key difference between just thinking of yourself and realizing your life choices have to also include those you love and are responsible for. And that will mean sacrifice. You know, I look at my life with my husband, I could have done a lot of things had I split when we were 30, but none of them would have ever been as interesting, important, or meaningful as the life we've created. And I can't believe this hour, like, again, flew by. So we're going to have to continue part two. My guest, Michelle Wiener Davis, if people want to get in touch with you, you do intensives with couples. Are you still taking couples? And can they reach out to you?
Yeah. Just go to divorcebusting.com and there's tons of information there about me.
And we didn't get to touch on it, but you and I both work in an intensive format where instead of coming week after week, people get to come work with you for an intensive weekend and really get into it.
We'll have to do that next time.
Yes, we will. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast to share with others because this is just part one. We're going to go into part two. And also you can get in touch with Michelle if you'd like more information. But as always, thank you for tuning in, listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
They didn't have you where I come from. Never knew the best was yet to come. Life began when I saw your face, and I hear your laugh like a serenade. How long do you wanna be loved? Is forever enough? Is forever enough?